With Shohaku Ogamura, who is also sort of one of my teachers. And he practices in the very plain way of Kodo Sawaki Roshi, who, as I mentioned yesterday, was a Dharma brother of my Dharma grandfather, Hashimoto Eko Roshi. And both had this idea of going back to the most ancient, most simple practice. And Shoryu-san is founding a temple and monastery, Gyobutsuji, in Arkansas, and he and two of his folks drove up 9 hours to be here for Sesshin. And you can see a little bit of Shoryu-san's writing also in an online magazine called Ancient Way. Google Ancient Way. And just, there was just an article released by you.
Right.
And I haven't had a chance to read it yet because I was preparing for Sesshin when I got it.
Right.
But go and read that. That should be very interesting and helpful. So, sure, you.
Good morning. It's very nice to be here, and I really appreciate Zuiko-san inviting us up, and it's really nice to be in Cedar Rapids again, and I didn't want to give folks the idea yesterday that we had an ordeal coming up here or anything. I was trying to make a joke, but it was kind of silly. It's actually, you know, it's beautiful weather, and we had a really nice drive, and the time went by quickly, but maybe a little too quickly because we were late, and I'm sorry about that for the first evening. But I really appreciate the preparation and all the effort that you put into doing this session. It's always, the ones that I've been to have been very well organized and just lovely, and it's so nice to have a chance to just settle in and not do as much as I usually do. Not to be in charge, you know, so to speak. So it's a great gift.
Yeah.
okay, so I'll get started. Yesterday, we talked about the story of Angulimala. And some of you, well, many of you have heard it now. We definitely heard it yesterday, but put my glasses here. Just briefly, basically, it's a story of an ancient story from the Buddha's time. It could be historically true. There's basically a mass murderer who tried to murder the Buddha, actually, but became sort of redeemed by just the Buddha's example and the Buddha's insight into the reality of life. And so we talked about that. We talked about redemption and forgiveness and how these things are realized in the present moment through practice. And that was the Buddha's main teaching, I think, from my perspective. And so I'd like to continue just discussing forgiveness, especially and how we realize that in our lives, and what does it really mean. And perhaps today it might be interesting to sort of first start out by thinking about forgiveness from the perspective of the families, maybe of the people that Angulimala killed. So, you know, Angulimala, the murderer, was forgiven by in his practice and redeemed and attained so-called, you know, realization. And but still, it comes out in the story, the cause and effect, the legacy of his deeds were not erased by his becoming a monk and by his realization. There, you know, was still suffering, and he had to pay the price somewhat for that. He himself was attacked, you know, even after he was a monk, even after he was so well respected by so many other people. There were some that still wanted to get him because of what he had done in the past. So when we think about forgiveness in our own lives, do any of us have something lurking in our belly, maybe, you know, something that somebody did to us, or something that's happened in this culture or in this society that we're really angry about and that we can't let go of? You know, this happens. You know, I think about those people who, the families of those people that died in a church, you know, while they were praying. This guy comes in and kills your brother or something because he's, you know, in a church praying. So often, you know, these things happen, these types of things, not necessarily murder, but just natural tragedies, or somehow it seems that life gives us something that we really just can't let go of. So, with that maybe in the background, I'll talk a little bit about the word forgiveness itself. And I think that this is interesting. I actually looked up the definition from two different sources, some online dictionaries, and got some, there's a subtle difference in these two definitions. The first one is from the Collins English Dictionary, and it actually gives four definitions, but I'll just mention the first two so we can save a little time. It says, forgiveness is to cease to blame or hold resentment against someone or something. And then the second definition is to grant pardon for a mistake or wrongdoing, etc. Then I found this other definition from Webster's New World College Dictionary. And the first definition is to give up resentment against or the desire to punish, stop being angry with, pardon. All of those were equal. The second definition is to give up all claim to punish or exact penalty for an offense, to overlook. So I don't know if anyone noticed, but the second set of definitions kind of combined the first two definitions from the first entry. It's really interesting. And I went back and actually looked at this again, and it turns out that the definition that came up in the Collins Dictionary was actually British English. And the second one was American English. And actually, when I brought up the Collins American definition, it was the same as this second one. So maybe this is a cultural thing. But basically, the first definition clearly separates giving up resentment and pardoning. And the second definition is to grant a pardon. So those are two different definitions of forgiveness. One is to cease to hold resentment, to forgive, you know, emotionally. And the second one is to grant pardon for a mistake. Two different meanings. But the one from the New World Dictionary, Webster's New World Dictionary, says to give up resentment, the desire to punish, stop being angry with, pardon. All in one definition. So, to me, it's very interesting because it almost equates one's emotional state with the ability to pardon someone. So, I think this is kind of a mistake we make often, is that we think that, you know, if we've been wronged and we're angry with somebody and there's some real emotional energy there, that we deserve some sort of emotional placating before pardoning can happen or before forgiveness can happen. And we even think that it's because we're emotionally upset, we have the right to pardon. You know, we have some kind of moral or ethical higher ground almost because we feel emotionally victimized or offended, or we're just mad, you know. So that's the difference between those two definitions, I think. But it's kind of dangerous ground, you know. Of course, because we know, you know, the teachings of Buddhism, that very often, you know, our emotions are pretty far off. And we can't really trust the fact that because we perceive someone as evil or wrong or having done us harm, that is ultimately true. You know, sometimes it may be quite obvious that it's true, actually. If you're the father of someone who was murdered by Angulimala, I mean, I think it's pretty obvious that you have been wronged in a so-called, you know, objective sense. But we don't always have such clarity. And the other part of it is when we do have the real bare-bone facts like that, what if there's no way to have the emotional placating? So the first definition says, and I think we often sort of feel this, that before real forgiveness can happen, we have to feel not angry anymore, or we have to feel justice has been served, or somehow at least there's been some attempt to make things right on the case in your perspective. But often that doesn't happen. What happens if we don't know who perpetrated a crime against us? Or on a broader scale, what happens? We can get mad about just some act of nature, or you know, you lose your home in a natural disaster, you don't have insurance, and it seems, you know, life has done you wrong. And so what do you do? Or what do you do if the person who does this wrong against you is not repentant, or they don't recognize it as something wrong? So we can all imagine, and we've probably been in situations like this where you just feel something is wrong and you can't let it go. You know, you just can't. You can't forgive. So when we do that, when we equate our emotional state with our ability to forgive, we limit our ability to forgive a lot. And then the more difficult part too, the more dangerous part is that we might actually be equating our emotional state with our right to judge someone else or to judge a certain situation. Even if it's subconscious, you know, it might be very subtle, something we don't actually realize. So you see this has happened in cultures too. You see cultures that have been fighting for generations because no one's been able to let go, you know. And even if some act is not perpetrated on you, so to speak, you can inherit this kind of thing and really get upset about it and feel that it's the truth. So what did the Buddha have to say about this kind of thing? Well, in a very ancient text, he said, focus not on the rudeness of others, not on what they've done or left undone, but on what you have and haven't done yourself. So in other words, he's saying you have to take responsibility for your forgiveness. We can't really change other people. You know, we have some limited effect on the world, of course. We can do work in the world and try to do good things and bring about social change, so for example. But when it really comes down to it, we can only change the activities and emotional state of our own being. We can only open our own heart, ultimately. And this is what he's saying here. So what do we do when we do find ourselves in this place of not being able to let go? And even if we do decide to take responsibility, how do you just let go, you know? Well, I have a example from my own life that I'd like to share with you. And it happens quite a few years ago. I just felt that I had been deeply wronged by somebody, by a close friend. And it was a difficult situation, and then, you know, I just had to cope with it. I didn't sort of get what I thought was an apology, and the things didn't turn out happily ever after. It was just a difficult situation. So I just had to live with it for a while. And some years down the road, when I was really trying to focus on my own heart and mind and look more deeply in my own practice, I realized, you know, I was still really clinging to a lot of pain and a lot of judgment about you know, about the other person involved in this. And I realized, you know, that's not really Bodhisattva attitude. It's not really what we're trying to do here, is to think that person, you know, was really did wrong and was bad, and I was, you know, wronged and a victim and woe is me kind of thing. But the hard part was, even when I realized this intellectually, that this was going on, I couldn't really let go of it. I tried sort of changing the narrative, you know, cognitively, just thinking it out and, you know, thinking of, well, you know, the emptiness of everything and and just how, you know, and how, you know, and that helps. Actually, it helps, you know, it does help to know that. But sometimes, well, Uchama Roshi said, you know, the baby's crying. Even if you know, like, these teachings, sometimes the baby keeps on crying. And you gotta feed the baby, you know, you don't just starve a baby. Like, so our little baby inside, you know, is crying. It was done wrong, and it needs justice, and it needs help, you know. But you can't give a baby the teachings of emptiness, you know. They don't respond to that very well. They just keep crying, all, you know, all the... all the louder when you do that. And that's what was going on with me. So, at some point, I realized I thought I was approaching it in the wrong direction, because in Soto Zen, in Dogen Zenji's tradition, the point is not to get to some state of awakening and then everything's okay, I think. The point is to express awakening now, here and now. Mm-hmm. So rather than trying to, of course we have to do both. I mean, we have to work on this body and mind and try to feed the baby sometimes, or somehow see how we can do things better. You know, but we do that only in the present moment. You know, if we're not being present, if we're not trying to express truth or enlightenment now, you know, we can't make any plan for the future, or we can't come into accord with our past, or, you know, take responsibility and come to terms with our past, unless we do it right here, you know, right now. I think that's what he was saying. But so anyway, I realized that this the emotional state wasn't as important as the expression of what I wanted to express. So I got this idea of doing bows, doing bowing practice. I think it was somewhat kind of out of desperation, actually. Doing bowing practice, and when I did these bows, you know, I'd offer incense to a Buddha image or a Buddha statue. And by the way, which I don't think, you know, when we do this is a form of idol worship or, you know, some kind of esoteric practice, although, you know, it's had that element in our tradition, no doubt. But for me, you know, these statues are a practice themselves. They're an expression of Zazen. And someone has, you know, gone to the trouble in their practice and created this beautiful statue for us to create an environment of practice. And so we're continuing and honoring our Zazen, or this person's practice and our practice, by, you know, and to the Buddha it represents, we're honoring that, whether it's Shakyamuni or the entire works, whichever way we want to think about it. So we're, you know, we're honoring that when we bow, and we're practicing, we're continuing the practice of the statue and the person who made the statue when we bow. So I began doing this, and then when I bowed, I said some kind of little wish for this person. May they be well and happy and joyful, and may they be, you know, happy the rest of their lives, and express enlightenment. So I did that. I started doing that. At first, it was painful, you know, when I was doing the bows, and it was really kind of hard to get it out, you know, to say that. But after a while, I realized that it was there was really some release happening when I did this, and it was sort of one of the only times during the day that I wasn't kind of feeling, you know, walking around with this narrative in my head and this thing in my gut, you know, when I was bowing. So it was almost as if the act of bowing, you know, itself was brought up or released something, or brought up some kind of joy and some kind of mind, just some expression of truth. And after some time, I can really say that it just went away. This deep feeling, you know, the gut of, like, of injustice, and it was just kind of gone. You know, the thoughts didn't disappear, or the emotions didn't totally disappear, but it was more like, you know, when they came up, they could just kind of go, and I didn't have to, you know, grab them like that. And they still come up sometimes, like, oh, remember that? Remember that crummy situation? And then I remember, oh, wait a minute. You're through with that. You don't have to go through that again. That's, go on. That's an old one. Go on to the next one. Go on to the next layer. Try to deal with that one. So I started thinking about this when I was preparing the talk and when I was working on another project. And, you know, why is it that this could happen? And I got to feeling, I feel now that we can think of our this kind of bowing practice as a form of Zazen, actually. You know, it's a way that we can step outside of our own suffering. And, you know, Dogen Zenji actually did not call Zazen a type of meditation, or he... You know, we don't hear anything in his teachings so much about... Well, let me take that back, because he did... He actually did write a chapter in the Shobogenzo about bowing. Mm-hmm. And I think explained how it is a Zazen. So, and he recognized that other types of activities are actually... can be an expression of Zazen. But the word Zazen itself means sitting meditation. But it's not really a form of meditation in the true sense of the word. We usually think about meditation as some way to kind of relax the mind or focus the mind or relieve stress or, you know, get to some other kind of trance state, which is all fine. But it's not Dogen Zenji's Zazen. That Zazen is, he says... The Dharma gate of peace and joy, nirvana, in other words, it is undefiled practice enlightenment. So for him, it was the expression of truth itself. And, you know, the reason that can be is that we are living in truth, you know, but we tend to live in our head, you know. And we really grasp those ideas that come up about ourselves and other people. And the emotions especially make them very powerful. So we usually live there instead of living in the reality, the truth of here and now. He gave a lot of teachings to try to point to us how the here and now is actually the complete expression of everything, you know. So... When we sit in Zazen, all of these emotions are coming up, and they're all they might be associated with thoughts and different sensations. But of course, we just let them all go when they come. We don't grasp onto them, and we don't judge them. We don't push them down, but we don't entertain them. You know, Suzuki Roshi said, "You leave the front door of the mind open and the back door open, and you let thoughts just come in the front door and go out the back, but you don't invite them in for tea. You don't have tea with them." So that's what we do. And Uchama Roshi called it opening the hand of thought, you know. Kind of goes with Angulimala, who collected fingers of his victims. And, you know, we kind of thought it was interesting how that grasping, you know, he seemed to be sort of grasping just for something he could never attain, even though he was the most powerful person around in that day and time, and could, you know, subjugate almost anybody physically. He just went on this relentless rampage of gathering fingers and didn't meet the answer to his question about life or his endeavor until he met, you know, a very gentle, soft-spoken person that he couldn't dominate and couldn't subdue. But anyway, so we grasp onto the thoughts. The finger image is, you know, kind of related to that. We you know, grasp onto something and think that it's real. But in Zazen, we let it go, and we let it run its course. And so the reality of life, whatever we want to call it, is there. And we don't have to do anything to be, we're always in it, but we usually live here instead of, you know, here. So I think this is what can happen in bowing too. It can happen in any activity, and actually Dogen Zenji wrote about how to do that, how to express this mind of Zazen while cooking, for example, in his Tenzo Kyokun, which was really, it's really a metaphor in there of how to make Zazen expressed, how to express it in your everyday life of cooking. He used cooking just sort of as a metaphor for what we do in life in general, off of the cushion, I think. But I think there's one thing I'd like to say too. It's important to remember that we don't do Zazen, or we don't bow, or we don't cook in order to placate our emotions, or get better, or feed the baby, or express forgiveness even. We don't do it in order to do that, because if we do that, you know, the Buddha said that the problem, as I said a moment ago, the problem is that we hold on to our views and we cling to what we think is right about reality, rather than express reality, the reality that is with us all the time. So if we're sitting a Zazen, or if we're doing bows in order to become more emotionally healthy, there's some way that we have a subtle agenda there, even though it's a very, you know, it is a very wholesome one, but it is an agenda. And the healing power of just this kind of absolute forgiveness of the here and now can only be expressed when we let go of even that. Mm-hmm. And so we just sit Zazen, you know, for its own sake, or we just cook for its own sake, or we just bow, you know, for its own sake. I noticed when I was doing the bowing practice that after a while, and it was such a relief, and so I would start thinking, oh, this is kind of, you know, this is cool, or I'm doing something really, you know, nice here. And in that moment, it was just, you know, it was back to sort of my agenda, or my world again. You know, this, I was the center. But this is why we can think of it as an offering. You know, you sort of offer up the self and your agenda, even to become wholesome, or to become, you know, kind to other beings. There can be a subtle kind of self-centeredness to that, you know, if we're holding on to the agenda. But if we just do it, then we're expressing it, and it doesn't matter, you know, how we feel about it, or, you know, how we get rewarded for it, or how we see ourselves or others see us. We just express it, and that's the practice, I think. So we have to let go of that, you know, subtle view or agenda, this self, that is the self-involvement. And that's why you always hear Zen teachers say, sit Zazen just for Zazen's sake, or, you know, just bow, or just cook. So the point I was kind of making about that, and this is a way that we actually sort of realize that a kind of absolute forgiveness of ourselves and others, and actually we can't separate those. You know, we can't be sort of forgiven of our own clinging to our emotions about others, for example, unless we forgive ourselves, you know, completely, and we have to see ourselves and accept ourselves, and then let go. You know, we can't let go of who we are until until we completely accept and see ourselves. And then when we, you know, so letting go of all of it is this sort of absolute forgiveness, this absolute redemption. The same one I think that Angulimala realized. So I think that's probably enough. That's all we really have time for. It's I think we go till 10:30 and it's 10:27. So if anybody had a comment about this, that'd be great. We could.
It seemed really easy until it got very tricky.
Letting go.
Yeah, I mean, you took it one more level, and it was like.
Oh, that. This.
Yeah.
Is there?
Yeah, the you know, sitting for sitting's sake, mm-hmm. cooking for cooking's sake, you know. Doing things unselfconsciously and naturally from who knows where instead
right.
of the ego.
Right, right.
So as long as we're not thinking, I'm doing a good thing, then we're doing a good thing.
Yeah, and those thoughts, you know, you can't help a thought of doing a good thing coming up. It might come up, but you can always let it go.
Mm.
You know, if you're paying attention,
mm-hmm.
but a lot of times we kind of don't. And so we go with it. But eventually, whenever, if it's an hour later and you catch it, or, you know, you can let it go. You always have the possibility. And that's one of the most beautiful things about Dogen Zenji's practice or his teaching, was that you have the opportunity in any particular moment to express it. Kenjo Koan, you know, the fundamental point, let go, enlightenment through all time and space. Lofty words, but then the next moment, you might think of it again. You might think I'm really cool because I just realized all time and space and enlightenment, you know, or something. And there you are, back in samsara. So that's the part that's hard. Why he's really tough, because he's, you know, he's really out, doesn't give you a break either. He says you got to keep on doing it over and over again, in every moment. But the possibility is always there for the complete expression.
I want to speak a little bit more to that idea of doing something for the sake of something.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause I think, if we're really honest, that's how most, if not all of us, come to practice, is we realize there's something about us that needs to change, or we want to improve something about ourselves in some way.
Mm-hmm.
And my teacher would say there, or Dayan Roshi would say, there's three doors to practice. One is impermanence, another one is repentance, and the third one is self-improvement. And she said that the third one, self-improvement, is a revolving door, because you can go in the palace to get the air conditioning, and then you're coming right back out. Unless you have those other two doors that you can enter into of impermanence and repentance.
Yeah.
So I think self-improvement or chasing after something is a valid entryway into the Dharma, as long as we have those other two doors at hand as well.
Mm-hmm.
Because I don't see how we can not have thoughts of, I've got to do this better. Yet we can remember some other aspect of the teaching of the practice and then manifest that.
Right.
So that entrance way, I think, of self thought is an entrance way, but
yeah,
it's just that we need to keep the other ones in mind. Otherwise, we'll just go right back out. And
right.
As long as we continue to think about getting something. And if we
yeah.
keep that as our only motivation, it's just not gonna.
Yeah.
It's not gonna do it.
That's right. That's right. Yeah.
And one other thing, just a different subject, but not related. That is the difference between forgiving and forgetting.
Mm-hmm.
And I think our, as far as forgiveness goes, that's one practice, and it doesn't necessarily mean forgetting.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. We can forgive, but it doesn't mean we need to forget, because otherwise we can set ourselves up inadvertently for being having the same thing happen to us because we didn't learn from the previous experience.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good point, because it's the same sort of teaching with, you know, Angulimala. You don't let go of cause and effect. You forgive, but you have to still try to be wiser and do your best to do it better the next time, or to have some kind of insight into the situation. And that's another whole topic too. Broadening our perspective and understanding our own part in, you know, the things that we think are done badly to us, you know, and can we see it from someone else's perspective, and can we, you know, grow? I think that's what real perspective, I mean, real forgiveness is that it enables you to broaden your perspective to, because resentment is really small, and your world is very dark and self-absorbed, but forgiveness, you know, is big. Mm-hmm. And it tries to take into consideration the point of view of others as well, and broaden, you know, rather than constrict. Mm-hmm. So, but it doesn't mean being, you know, ignorant or naive either. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Good point, definitely.
Well, I think of Pope John Paul II, I think, had an attempt on his life, and he went and pardoned the person who had done this, and I think that's a good example of him being able to kind of look outside of this act that had been intended on him, and to see that person suffering, and that, you know, the, you know, that the, you know, and just to be able to, I don't know, just be able to, you know, give them that for themselves, and whether or not they, I guess, accept it or not, mm-hmm. isn't anything you have control over either. Mm-hmm. So, because they may have their own mental state going on, whether they're just not as aware or a mental illness or whatever.
Yeah.
But I think, I mean, maybe it was important more for him to just be able to do that and say, you know, hey, you know, it's okay, and I'm letting this go, and continue. I don't.
Yeah, that's a really good example, and yeah, it just occurs to me too. Like, if you're the Pope, it's got to be. I mean, just think about it, because there's the. What's his? What was his name before he was the Pope? Do you remember anybody?
Which one?
Yeah. Not the current
Pope,
right?
John Paul II. The one.
This was John Paul II.
Oh, the two before.
This was two. Okay, this was two before the one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway, so there's him, the individual who was the role, you know, of the Pope. And but then, like, he had a job to do. You're like, you gotta be the Pope, and you can't hold resentment, or you can't, you know. You can't hold a grudge. You gotta offer forgiveness as the Pope, and so it's sort of similar to what we do too. We have to just step outside of our individual, you know, self-absorption, and think about the vow. You know, for example, that can help us think about our Bodhisattva vow, and take on, you know, the role. Something beyond us, of just an individual person trying to get by, and so yeah, that can be helpful to think about things from a bit bigger perspective.
Well,
yeah,
maybe it may appear to be the right thing to do and the good thing to do, and maybe you don't even really feel it when you're doing it, but at least maybe it can help cultivate those feelings in you. Maybe getting back to kind of your original, you know, or that definition that you gave, where it's kind of all in one. You know, you're maybe you forgive, or you pardon with the hope that does lead to forgiveness and to relief of some sort.
Yeah. So it kind of comes back into Daishin's, you know, point that we have to have some understanding or some vehicle to go to forgiveness. You know, we have to have an appreciation for the teachings or some reason or some faith, you know, so to go there at all. Otherwise, it just seems meaningless. There's no no reason to do it. But then once we step into that, you know, we give it all up. Once we actually step into the practice, that's when we practice with just completely expressing forgiveness or zazen or whatever.
This merit can universally to all, so that we together with all beings realize the Buddha way. Beings are numberless, I vow to free them. Delusions are inexhaustible, I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless, I vow to enter them. The Buddha way is unsurpassable,